Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. Today on the pod, I spoke with Sunyoung Choi Morrow. She is executive director at the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. We talked about the crisis pregnancy centers and the decision out of the Supreme Court that ruled that these centers do not need to disclose that they are non-medical facilities and that they do not offer abortion services. So she really talks about the particular danger to women of color and low-income women and how these centers actually target low-income areas and communities of color to set up shop.
And oftentimes it is low-income women and women who aren't familiar with the U.S. medical system because they didn't grow up here or they have limited English or their families just don't, you know, have a comfort level with navigating the medical system, that these just become very readily accessible.
So before we get to that, obviously today is a Friday, not a Thursday. Because of the holiday, we ended up pushing today's show back, but we are here. Also because of this holiday, unfortunately, Varsha and I were not able to hook up in terms of schedule, so we're not doing a news block today, but we have plans going forward to do news blocks for you on Mondays and Thursdays together. She loves doing it. Y'all love hearing it. I love hanging out with Varsha. It's a win-win-win-win. So look forward to that for Monday and next Thursday. I also want to take a second to introduce the newest member here at Hellbent headquarters. A friend of mine, Andrew Walsh, is going to be helping us with our website, finally getting all the show notes up on the episode. He's also going to help me with editing work. So he's kind of our new associate editor / website magician. He actually cut today's interview. So this is his big debut on working on the show. I'm so excited to, like I said, get some help and to teach other people who want to eventually do this. He wants to start his own podcast someday, and I'm happy to have him on the team. He is really great, and I think he's in the group now, so I'm sure he will say hi. And we're really excited to have some help and to get people supporting the cause. And I promise the website will actually be updated now, so I'm very excited about that. Be sure to give him a warm Hellion welcome. I do want to just pronounce a very quick Hellion of the week before we get into this interview. This Hellion dovetails very nicely with the breaking news from yesterday. So I think, as we all know now, Scott Pruitt resigned as head of the EPA because he is a lying monster scandal factory. So he finally did end up resigning after being investigated for not one, not two, not 10, but 13 separate scandals, which I feel like we're just in a fucking Onion article now. Like, what the fuck is going on? I know exactly what's going on. Scott Pruitt pushed the policies that this administration wanted, that these lobbyists wanted. He was so central in crafting the destruction of the EPA regulations that protect us, that of course he could stay. It doesn't matter if he spends $45,000 on a security booth or wears tack pants. Like, that's fine. That's cool. Whatever. The other problem is, now that he stepped down, the deputy director, who is now the head of the EPA, Andrew Wheeler, he is a formal coal lobbyist. So that's kind of like letting the fox into the hen. I mean, that's sort of like, honestly, I think the best metaphor is letting a coal lobbyist run the EPA. I mean, what the actual fuck are people thinking? I mean, the absolute depth of corruption and just intentional destruction is breathtaking. So, but anyway, back to the Hellion of the week. This is a woman named Kristen Mink. She is a teacher and a mother of a two-year-old, and she was eating lunch in Washington, D.C. when she noticed Scott Pruitt was sitting a few tables away. And so because she's a badass Hellion, she's like, well, I have to say something. She said, quote, he's directly impacting the future of the world. She said, quote, this is my son. He loves animals. He loves clean air. He loves clean water. Meanwhile, you're slashing strong fuel standards for cars and trucks for the benefit of big corporations. We deserve to have someone at the EPA who actually does protect our environment. Somebody who believes in climate change and takes it seriously for the benefit of us all, including our children. I would urge you to resign before your scandals push you out. So, first of all, love the modern day soothsayer who knew that this, who, you know, could feel the scandals crushing him. But at the same time, it shouldn't take scandals. Someone who is against environmental protection should not run the Environmental Protection Agency. This is not fucking difficult. And I know we're talking about a new level of incompetence here, but you gotta be fucking kidding me. And now that Scott Pruitt's out, Andrew Wheeler's up. He's also an environment-hating monster who I can only assume is also a scandal machine, because honestly, at this point, why not? And, you know, again, this sort of takes us back to the civility conversation where there are all these people on the right mostly who are saying, you know, we really shouldn't bother people while they're out having lunch or dinner, or if you see them on the street, like, they're people too. Yeah, they're fucking people, but you know what? They're people who are doing terrible things. And like I said before, our these shitty policies are not just 9 to 5. Our activism is not just 9 to 5. So you know what, Scott Pruitt? Fuck you, boy, bye. I can't wait until we get Andrew Wheeler out too, because he sounds just as fucking terrible. And Kristen Mink, thank you for being a hellion. Thank you for standing up and saying what needed to be said. You are a perfect example of the women our country needs. The women who need to say what needs to be said and who are going to lead us out of this fucking mess. Our guest today is Sungyoung Choi Morrow, and she is the executive director at the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. She's a first-generation immigrant to the U.S. and a seasoned organizer and activist. Thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Sure thing.
Yeah, of course. So I really want to talk to you about the recent Supreme Court decision, which was NIFLA versus Becerra, that was about crisis pregnancy centers. So basically, this ruling said that these centers do not have to disclose that they're not medical facilities and they do not offer abortion services. Why is this so dangerous for abortion rights?
Well, as you know, in this country, it is already difficult for women and all people in general to get medically accurate sexual education or support, especially for women who want to choose and the option of terminating their unwanted pregnancy. And we think that this ruling is especially dangerous because not only is it, you know, people having, you know, their opinions about whether women should be able to choose or not, but it's predatory, right? Like, they're deceiving women into their so-called clinics, and lying to them and giving them false information. And so that's really, you know, it to me feels just like one more step further into invasive and deceptive practices to control women and women's bodies. And so that's why this is particularly alarming. And we all know that many of these places are set up in communities of color, targeting low-income women and oftentimes women of color. And so this is particularly concerning to us.
You said that. You said, quote, many set up shop in low-income and communities of color to take advantage of vulnerable women. So why set up in these areas specifically? Why are they targeting these women specifically?
Because low-income women and often women of color don't have good medical access to begin with. Oftentimes, they don't have a regular, you know, OBGYN day visit or even regular physician day visit. And so when you find yourself in a situation of especially unwanted pregnancy, you know, you're looking for the easiest accessible way to get medical help or medical advice. And I think they're just available. And, you know, they have these names like, you know, Women's Health Center, and, you know, just sounds very welcoming. And women go because they say they want to provide women with options. But, you know, it's just like, it is a front to lure women in, and oftentimes it is low-income women and women who aren't familiar with the U.S. medical system because they didn't grow up here or they have limited English or their families just don't, you know, have a comfort level with navigating the medical system, that these just become very readily accessible for them.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, there's definitely a lot of lying and lies of omission going on here. So what are the practical consequences of these crisis pregnancy centers not offering information about, you know, legal medical services and disclosing the fact that they're not medical centers? So what are some of the kind of worst consequences of that?
I mean, you know, I actually recently heard from a colleague that there was a woman who actually wanted to keep her pregnancy and got wrong information, medically inaccurate information, ended up losing, you know, having a miscarriage because of a CPC, right? Because of one of these fake clinics. So that's the danger of it. And when you are, you know, I don't know anywhere else in this country where unlicensed anything are allowed to operate within that area of expertise without a license, right? Like, you can't even sell liquor without a liquor license. So to me, you know, it's crazy that, like, something that is as important as women's health and women's life would be treated with this kind of disregard.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And this case in the Supreme Court was argued largely as a free speech issue. And these clinics were saying that their free speech is being limited because they don't, it goes against their faith, basically. I mean, I find that to be disingenuous. So why, I mean, do you think this is a free speech issue or something else?
I mean, I have to say also from, personally, as a Christian, I'm an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church. I grew up in a missionary home with, you know, my father is a minister. Like, I find their position of their religious freedom to be extremely offensive and very disheartening. This is not what our faith is built on. We do not protect our, whatever our values may be, by deceiving and lying to people. That is fundamentally not part of our faith. And to me, that is also that's one of the reasons why this particular case is very personally upsetting to me, that they're using this front of their religious values and religious morals, that somehow that is protecting their religious values is much more important than women's lives. Like, the irony of it is that is not part of the Christian tradition. The Christian tradition does not teach people to lie and deceive people in order to further our own agenda. That is absolutely counter to our faith. And so to me, that is actually what's most upsetting about this case, is that they can't even have the decency to be like, we just want, you know, we want to get people to do things our way, no matter how we have to do it. They're using religion as an excuse. And, you know, it's the same people that are persecuting Muslims and all for the Muslim ban. So, you know, they're not being consistent in their, you know, in their religious protection of religion freedom. They only want to protect their particular religious freedom. So that's totally disingenuous.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is. So, you know, so the ruling was on a specific California requirement that required these clinics to disclose that they're non-medical facilities. And it feels like that's in direct conflict with rules that states like Texas have that force abortion doctors to read a script before they give an abortion or tell women certain things before they'll perform an abortion. So the ideological consistency just isn't here. So what is the argument that for the unevenness of the application of this law?
There is no argument, to be honest with you. I mean, it's just you can see how deeply seated, you know, our society is in misogyny, right? I mean, the way our culture hates women and is hell-bent on controlling our bodies. It's just really evident in all of these inconsistencies, whether it be about how they want to protect religious freedom for some and not others, right? Like when it's convenient for them, it's about the religious freedom. When it's not, then it's not about religious freedom. And when it's convenient for them to force, you know, providers to tell the truth or say, you know, whatever, then that's convenient to them, right? And so I like at this point, I don't even know that this is like, I can sit here and reason with you about what happened, because it just, to me is, there is, it's just like this nation hates women. Like that is, that has become evidently clear. If not before, right? Like just the, you know, just the way the treatment of it, like you're saying about the inconsistencies around, like, you know, the, what, like some states having requirements for women to have a waiting period or look at ultrasounds or whatever. Like it is absolutely inconsistent. And, but what's worse is that I just cannot believe that someone who is not a medical provider can lie about it or deceive women about it. Like, it just, to me, like that's like a whole nother level of this country and our government failing to protect its people, just at a very fundamental level, right? Like we have regulations to protect children. We have regulations that don't allow us to sell liquor to people under a certain age, you know, not allow to sell cigarettes to people under a certain age, and, you know, make people make disclaimers about all sorts of things. And I just can't believe that in a culture where that kind of regulation and oversight is a part of our culture, that somehow this piece of our life has an exception because it's to deal with women's bodies and this country wants to control women's bodies.
Right. And so for your organization, and you mentioned that poor communities and communities of color are more likely to be targeted. So this seems particularly dangerous for women of color. And like you mentioned, maybe people who didn't grow up here, who don't have experience navigating the medical system. So how is your organization getting involved to help women avoid these predatory crisis pregnancy centers?
Well, you know, I think for our community, like we have to take even a step further back, right? I think very much like in the rest of U.S. society, or maybe even more so, oftentimes our cultures and our communities don't lend itself for women to have conversations, whether with their family or with each other, around sexuality and sexual activity and, you know, just general basic sex ed. And there's a lot of shame around that. And so one of the things that we are doing is creating spaces for people and also training people to facilitate those conversations themselves, right? So we work with other organizations and women who are being a leader in that space to normalize talking about sex, talking about reproductive rights, talking about our dignity and our right to be able to make decisions, right? Like people aren't even in spaces where they know how to express that or talk about that. So I think that for us, you know, that's sort of the baseline that we're working off of. And then we are engaging. We found that there are some fake clinics that are located in Chinatowns or, you know, in areas where Asian Americans are. And we've been doing some activity this summer around raising awareness about these fake clinics around the country as a way to raise awareness and also send a message to these clinics that we know you're here and we know what you're doing, right? Oftentimes they think they're operating, you know, like under the radar and nobody knows who they are, you know, really. And so we've been doing some of that exposure work with our communities. But I think fundamentally what we need to be, you know, what we're aiming to do is really shift the culture within our communities to normalize talking about our bodies, our sexualities, and our reproductive choices, including abortion access. And, you know, this might be tangential, but, you know, I've heard, it was maybe about 6 months ago, I read a story about a South Asian woman who is now serving time for second-degree murder because she carried through with an unwanted pregnancy in Long Island, New York. I mean, this is not, you know, middle of nowhere, Mississippi, right? Like in Long Island, New York, she carried through with an unwanted pregnancy and ended up, you know, basically ending the baby's life after birth. And so she's been charged with murder. And it's such a heartbreaking, sad story to me, because in a place like New York, like, she should have had access to information and services. Right. And it's just that's just very telling of how closed our community is and how women don't know. Not to, like, you know, people keep talking about like the future of Roe, and I'm like, some of us live in the reality even in New York City, right? And so for me, our vision and our dream is that through our work in our organization, that we're connecting more women, one woman at a time, to connect with their community and their families, so that we're developing a network of folks who can really talk to and normalize conversations about our bodies and our choices.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, because I was doing a little research on crisis pregnancy centers for this story, and I noticed here in Los Angeles, most of the centers that I found were in communities of color or low income communities. Like, you don't see crisis pregnancy centers in Beverly Hills. And that's definitely, it's definitely very, very stark. So in connecting this community and creating more awareness, do you know if there are other states that had similar policies to California that required disclosure that are now nullified? Is this going to have a widespread effect, or is this more of a peremptory strike so that more states don't put these regulations in place?
Yeah, I actually am not aware of any other state that has a similar law that it's going to have an impact on. But I think what it's going to do is it's going to embolden anti-choice people, and, you know, this is sort of giving fuel to them to just keep doing what they're doing, right? I mean, the deception is to the point where, like, non-medical personnel are wearing scrubs and gowns, appearing to be medical providers, right? So this is just giving them more cover to do more of this, and that's what's really dangerous about it.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely a very complicated problem. Do you see a solution? You know, like you said, the community involvement and the awareness, but is there a way to, is there another way that maybe creatively that would make these crisis pregnancy centers see, like, expose them for the liars that they are?
I mean, I think for me, it's a more of a holistic solution, right? Like, part of it is making them irrelevant, right? Like, what are we doing, and how are we working towards culture shift and creating a society where those who are anti-choice become irrelevant to our society, right? Like, and I know that sounds really lofty and, like, so big out there, but I really think in times like this, that's what we have to hold on to, because we can't lose sight of our big, like, for me, it's always about, like, the world that I want to live in versus the fight, the things I want to fight, right? So much of our work becomes reactionary in moments like this. And as you know, this has been a really rough, I don't know if I can swear on your podcast, but if I could, you know, like, okay.
You absolutely can.
City fucked up week, right? For communities of color, especially for women of color. I mean, I've just had so many tearful days about, not only about NIFLA and Becerra, but about the Muslim ban and what that means for my immigrant, you know, my Muslim brothers and sisters, but broadly more our immigrant community. You know, the fact that they brought in korematsu, the justification for interning Japanese Americans into that case, and kind of reignited that pain in our community in that case. Like, there's just been so much pain in our community this week, this past week, that plus the landmark ruling around Janus versus AFSCME, which Janus, basically dismantles, really makes it difficult for the labor movement to keep its infrastructure. I mean, this Supreme Court has told working class everyday people over and over again that you do not matter in this country, that we don't give a shit about you, right? So, you know, it's in that context where everything seems to be falling apart that, like, for me, it's even more important that we think about what we're building and what we're what we want to create versus all the little fights we want to have to change the little things, right? And so more than ever, we need to have intersectional approach to all of our work, especially in the reproductive rights, health, and justice movement, where we're centering the experiences of women of color, because this isn't the only pain we're feeling today in this moment. It's not just about this win for the state clinics. We're also feeling the pain of the Muslim ban, and also a few weeks ago around the masterpiece ruling, and feeling the pain around Janice. And right. So also around the announcement of Kennedy's retirement. And so I think for me, it's really centering all of those things that really helped me think about, like, how do we approach this? That doesn't become like we're just going head to head on one issue, that we're making it broader. And I think for me, it's ultimately making sure that one of the things I've started doing is becoming so much more bold and unapologetic in spaces where it's not repro, about the fact that we live in a culture that hates women and are trying to control women's body. And you'd be surprised in some of these progressive spaces, that is not what they will agree with you, but they're uncomfortable that you're actually saying it. But I feel like that's what we need to do. It's not okay for you to tell me that we will get to violence against women once we get these other things done. Like, it is not okay for you to say that anymore. It's not okay for you to say, well, I'm not going to sign off on that because that's not our main issue. Like, those things are not okay anymore. And I think, at least personally for me, as a leader that sits in the immigrant rights space and economic justice space and the reproductive rights, health, and justice space, that part of it is really taking people to task every time, because I think we get into these silos and we're like, well, if we do our bit in our corner of the world, somehow all of us, you know, are in our little collective way, we'll be able to bring something about. But I think in this moment, it is really about the sum of all of us in a more intentional way that's really going to bring the power for us to say this is not okay and we're not standing for it.
Right. Do you feel that resistance? Do you feel that people are really taking up this mantle, even in the face of all of the darkness and this really shitty, fucked up week? I mean, there's a lot to be upset about, but I mean, I've spoken to many, many women doing the work like yourself. I mean, do you feel that resistance?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something about this week that fundamentally shifted many of us. I mean, as if, like, you know, the election of Trump wasn't that enough. I think there is this sense of we are going to continue to fight, right? Like, I mean, I think it's this holding this tension of being present in the pain that we are feeling. And at the same time, it's sort of like have this vision of the phoenix rising from the ashes. I just feel like we're having one of those moments. And I'm actually hopeful. I'm hopeful that we are coming together, and that history has shown us that in the darkest moments of this country and in our world, that somehow the goodness in people have overcome. Maybe not always, but we have done it in the past. And that's what I have, that's what I'm hopeful about. And I think a lot of us share that.
Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you for the work that you do. And the communities of color and women of color in particular have really taken the brunt of all of this shit. And it's so heartening to hear voices like yours. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'm so glad you called me and that we had this conversation.
Yeah, me too. So thank you again, and good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, Hellions, that's it for me. I love that our Hellion this week was a badass woman standing up for what she believes in, and our interview was also with a badass woman standing up for what she believes in. Sungyeon Choi Maro, who is the executive director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, was such a pleasure to have on. I cannot thank her enough for her insight and her willingness to sit down with us. She actually gave that interview from an airport because her flight was delayed, and that level of badassery just gets my cold feminist heart pumping. So, you know, please check out what their organization is doing, how they're getting involved. Like she said, getting more involved in comprehensive sexual education, as well as calling out what these crisis pregnancy centers are doing and fighting the good fight. And like she said, like a phoenix rising, we're coming back up. You can check them out at napawf.org. I highly encourage you to do so. They are doing great work. Have a great weekend, Hellions. Raise some hell. And remember to practice your empathy, just not on Scott Pruitt. He doesn't deserve any. I'll see you on Monday.